things that we currently do. The second half of this, the questions are going to focus more on solutions. What can we change? What should we change? And what ideas can we generate here that can help us preserve the future of Alachua County? So with that in mind, one of the folks that came up and were chatting with you right before I had to start this up had a really good question, and I don't know that I heard all of it. I just heard part of it. Can one of you guys that understood that question repeat it, and can we start the second half off with that question? That was the one about is there a trap in valuing conservation land in an economic way?
Well, that was his question. Did we think that perhaps, and I would rephrase it to say perhaps looking at conservation land solely as an economic entity is perhaps inappropriate, because there's a lot more to it. We don't place a very high value, for instance, now on fresh water. You can pour 10 gallons out of fresh water, good, clean, drinkable fresh water out of your tap. And what does that cost you? A few pennies. It's really worth a lot more than a few pennies. But the economic value of it in our current economic system is a few pennies. So, you know, we have this wonderful free enterprise system. I love it. And it puts a price on everything. And it's great for allowing businesses to run and people to grow food and sell food and other people to eat it and build houses and whatever. It's not entirely appropriate for projecting the value of a high-quality piece of conservation land for our grandchildren, or valuing the value of our aquifer underneath us. It has its limits. And so conservation land has values that go way beyond our economic system. That's what I would say.
Sorry, we're having a technical glitch at the same time you were giving that excellent answer. Are there others that would like to also add on to that, or you guys all think Bob did a fabulous job of answering?
I mean, I'll throw one more thing in there along those same lines. If we start getting to a point where we're trying to put an economic value on everything, one concern that's come up recently is there's been discussion of a bill that would basically say that land managers, you know, different state levels that are looking over conservation lands would have to look at it and consider whether or not it still has that value. So basically every 10 years, you know, like a comp plan, many other things we have in government where you're kind of doing a review every number of years to see if it's still relative, if it's up to date, does it need to be adjusted or amended. What they're talking about doing is basically saying, does this property, at least what I've seen so far come across, you know, emails and stuff, is that this idea that they're going to have to go back and look at every year. And what if suddenly it's all of a sudden it's degraded from the standpoint of whatever ecosystem service it's getting valued by? And so they say, well, now we can surplus that. I mean, I think that's a great concern. What's the value of each Nookie Springs to us? I mean, not just the economic value, but just the mindset that's there, that we can go there whenever we want. I mean, if that's lost or degraded, what does that mean to us? I think start getting the philosophical things, but I think there is a big part of that with Bob is, I think, getting to. And I mean, I can't put any dollar amount in Nookie Springs. I mean, that place is, you know, sacred to me. And so I think that's something we have to think about when we're looking at things just purely from an economic standpoint, because I think there's a lot of other models we could look at all conservation lands from.
So that's sort of the dichotomy, is we're in an environment where we're being asked to take our conservation lands and have them be somewhat self-supporting in some ways, and at the same time, we want to say that these are priceless things that we have. Is that?
I think that's very accurate.
Yeah. So, another thought. So, what kind of green practices? That's a very nebulous term that address natural resource conservation can be sustainable over the long term. So, in other words, what sorts of long term management and education is needed to retain the original intent of a particular management practice? So, things change over time. So, what? I see some of you nodding your heads like you understand that question. Mark, do you want to take a stab at that one?
I think I'll couch this in the terms of when we think of, how many of you have heard of conservation developments, subdivisions, green development? Yeah. I'll couch it in that terms because I've done some research over the years and have a lot of students look at green developments around the country and internationally. And far, I've never seen a green development function more than beyond the design. I see all kinds of things that infuse into a green development from both homeowner behavior, from contractors that come onto the construction site. And so one solution I think, and I've looked at the comp plan, I think there's a lot of good language in there about the intent of rural subdivision and clustering. I think that's excellent in terms of giving some incentives to builders and developers that would may take one unit per 5 acres or one unit per 3 acres and cluster in a smaller density. But going beyond that, how can we assure when we increase the density, when we give an incentive to someone to increase the density in the rural cluster design, how do we ensure that those increase in the homes and the homes in the land don't impact that conservation area that we just designed through clustering? And while the intent's there, I think what language could be added to the comp plan goes through three phases. One, I think we address a little bit about the design, so clustering. We're going to take the units off the land and cluster them in smaller lots. Okay, we got that. Secondly, think about construction. So even though you have a denser, compact community, which I think has many benefits for corridors, ecosystem services, and conservation of trees, you don't have any, well, you do have some language, but I would encourage more language within the comp plan that would address how earthwork machines, how the design of the built areas are in through the land development regulations actually address how does that compact community be designed and managed over the long term to minimize impacts on the conserved area. Because what I see is when you do conservation subdivisions, do you put people near conserved areas, those conserved areas degrade over time, whether it's ATVs running through the forest or whether it's an increased amount of fertilizer and irrigation that runs into the wetlands. I mean, the list are feral. The box about feral cats or feral cats being released into those areas and fed. There needs to be, and I think what we could do is not only address that construction phase, how you bring earthwork machines in and out. There's a whole technique to minimize compact soils. I mean, all those trees you conserve and you run a huge 4-ton earthwork machine over the root zone, the tree's going to make it over the next 5 to 10 years. So, or even quicker for some trees. And then what I think is put a kitty aside, so another incentive that says, okay, if you go one step beyond just design and you address really good sustainable construction practices, there'll be another incentive for that developer. Because what I think we need to do is create these model green communities that go through the design, construction, and post-construction phase. So what I would do for the post-construction phase is really how do you engage with people when they move into the community that they are not looking at the native vegetation saying, wait a minute, there's snakes in there. I want to put some turf grass in and I want to fertilize and go back to where I, you know, what I'm used to. So another way would be to have a long-term engagement program with the homeowners as they move into the community. Because that's the other thing I see is that the impacts to the conserved areas where they have a corridor could be from light, noise, pets, homeowner behavior. And if there's any way we could put into the comp plan how we address a funding mechanism that actually engages and manages the built space as much as the open space, I think that's where we could really solve a lot of our issues on management.
Well, currently, when a new developer goes into what I would call a green space development, where they're developing land that has not been developed before in the county, there's an impact fee that is paid by that developer for each lot that's developed. So impact fee is based on the square footage of the house and is not really based on lot size or the actual impact that that size of that development or that development has on the removal of that green space from all the green space that we have in the county. So if we're thinking about the impact fee structure as maybe one way to incentivize or disincentivize the kind of development that we want, do any of you have any ideas about how that might be a mechanism of conserving our natural resources in the county?
I don't want to dominate, but I'll just take a couple shots here. We worked with some conservation subdivisions in Colorado and New Zealand, a couple others, and we find that if you have a source there's two mechanisms that really work, well, two mechanisms that could work, one doesn't work too well. One is through homeowner association dues. So the homeowner association dues have bylaws that say a portion of it has to go through management. That works sometimes it doesn't, because homeowner associations change over time, and so the staying power depends on the community itself. But if you have a really good community that's engaged about natural resource conservation, those work well. The other is like a specialty tax. Like you said, impact fee is one way. I would say perhaps a millage tax that would go and ride with the lots that continually to provide funds that could be managed by the county. If we have enough of these funds, they could actually, I know it costs money to hire people to do this, but if you had enough of these specialty funds that would have a kitty to do this, then you have a third party manager that would go to each of these conservation subdivisions, say, is it functioning as we intended? Where's the issues and what do we need to do to maintain that original integrity that was the purpose of it? So those two mechanisms, I think, would work.
It's interesting to me that we started this question out by talking about green developments, but really where most of our problems lie are in just our standard developments. And so what can we do to bridge that gap in terms of how all development takes place and how that impacts natural resources and the environment? This is really partially, I'm stepping into next month's discussion, but when we think about the fact that our backyards are, you know, that interface between the built environment and the natural resources we're looking to protect, I feel like it belongs partially in this discussion as well.
So I'm going to try to focus on solutions here, since we sort of started the second half off with it. And I think there's, you know, when we're talking about some of these developments, I mean, I started out in construction and landscaping as a kid, because that was like where the money was at. It was easy and it was cash. That probably going to screw me for my political career, but that's all right. But the reality of it is, I think there's a lot to be said now. You look at most of the developments I've been seeing in Alachua County, you know, I think we've got a pretty good comp plan. And some of these developments you're talking about leaving some of these lands for conservation. Now, I think there's a great opportunity there. I'll start off with that one. At least there in that scenario, if you're doing do what Mark's talking about, there's that opportunity for education. You know, kids have that opportunity to have a natural area right out their back door. I think that's invaluable. Rather than have to go off site and go someplace to visit a conservation area or a natural area, whatever you want to call it, I think there's a great opportunity there for all of us, if it's maximized. If it turns into sort of a weed-infested place where people are afraid to go into and it's not managed, that can become sort of a nightmare down the line. That said, you know, when you're talking about strategic planning from a conservation standpoint, you know, another alternative, you talk about, you know, sort of standard development, sort of what I grew up as a kid, where basically every square inch of the farm was built, maybe beside some little buffer on the wetland. You know, if you're talking about doing some kind of impact fee or special assessment, or then maybe that's paid and then we go off and buy a piece of land that's strategically located next to Payne's Prairie or San Velasco or some existing conservation land, I think there's benefit there as well. But from some standpoint, I'm not necessarily, you know, advocating for that, but there is potentially a benefit from there, because at least, you know, we're talking strategically from a conservation standpoint, where we now recognize the importance of connectivity in creating these buffers, in essence, away from potential development and kind of keeping it out of some places and locating it in others. So I think there's, you know, a number of different opportunities and possibilities with that. I mean, I was just, again, to go back to where I was out in Colorado, one of the land trusts out in California, that's exactly what happened. These developers were basically supposed to be setting aside land. They didn't. They got caught with it. And so they had to set, you know, they had to get set a bunch of money aside, then part of the settlement out of this agreement. But it turned into a beautiful thing, and now they're protecting, you know, sort of whole valleys of areas that are really critical from, you know, from an agricultural standpoint as well as natural areas. So there can be good coming out of, I think, both models potentially.
Mark's on a roll here.
I think one of the things is just plain inertia. I mean, conventional development has been doing, you know, whatever. We have a whole host of engineers and consultants that have been doing ways of certain, you know, step by step, know which hoop to go through. We need to grab onto a maverick. You know, that one landowner or two landowners, that developer is going to do something different. Really grab onto them and push, you know, all the different green practices that we actually can see the model on the ground. Because I think that's what is really hard to overcome, that inertia, when you just have like myself or other people speaking about. But if you actually see it, you can take a construction worker and say, look at how these earthwork machines were going down only through the paved infrastructure, and all the built areas over here has really good topsoil. It's not and cleared off and filled in grade. And they say, well, how'd you do that? Well, you just took a little organization, a little thought about how you would take the earthwork machines in and out of the construction site. I think once we have those on the ground, then things will, I mean, it's hard to get that first one.
Well, you know, I'm looking out, and I don't see a lot of representation from the Builders Association, for instance, at this meeting. I mean, we got one, awesome, but there's not a lot of builders here. Then they're not, you know, it's not part of their thought process. Not to say that there aren't some builders trying to do some really good things, but one of the jobs that I had 7 or 8 years ago was a sustainability consultant for a very green development called Brighton, which was really trying to think outside of the box, was really trying to do a good thing. They were doing LEED for neighborhoods, they were doing LEED homes. Mm-hmm. They had worked with all of the local agencies. They even paid a ton of money to have some poppy mallow, what are those things called, the, you know, endangered plants moved and made an area for conservation of those where they impact. I mean, they were really trying hard to do everything right. And these were developers that had done it, you know, the standard way for many years, and they were trying to leave a legacy project. Well, then what happened? The economy crashed. And so now, you know, they've left this legacy of the green project didn't even work, you know, and so and now it's becoming a standard development. It's no longer green, although it is very dense. I don't know what point I was trying to make with that other than just telling that story, but it's really difficult to take convince the builder to take that extra step. I know, because I try to do it every day. So so what, you know, what are some steps that we can take as a county in order to incentivize that kind of construction if we believe that that is a good way to go?
Well, I, you know, obviously I think, you know, better built environment is important, but I think it isn't just about new subdivisions or new developments. I think part of the challenge that, you know, city officials have, and, you know, I was very excited to be a part of for a number of years, is you have to really make proactive steps to make living in a denser environment more desirable. I mean, if you don't really go out of your way to, you know, have urban parks and have nice spaces downtown and great places to go to eat and see plays or whatever, people do want to flee out of the city, and that has sort of been the urban story of America since the 50s. I think it has been turning around, not just here, but across America. So that's certainly part of it. What I was going to share, though, and you actually sort of hit on it, I mean, this is a great group of people who care about these issues, but, you know, there are many, many people who don't wake up in the morning worried about, you know, what percentage of the land we ought to conserve. And from that perspective, I think that we need to work toward, you know, policies, programs, projects that meet multiple different needs. And one of the things that I've really seen work in the work that I've done for the Trust for Public Land, and the closest example, this was not something I worked on, but was the Better Jacksonville Plan that was a sales tax that goes on essentially forever. I mean, it goes out until 2030 or something, and it was adopted when John Delaney was mayor. But it had very robust conservation funding, sales tax, but it also included funding for the criminal justice system and for the schools and for the libraries and for the roadway network and so on. And so that is something we haven't ever really, you know, pursued. We started out with Wild Spaces, Public Places in that direction, but it, you know, for whatever set of reasons, it didn't end up the those who were the advocates for the school funding and the roads funding sort of looked at the economy and said, we don't want to do it right now. And so I said, well, let's do just the parks and the land and we'll meet you back in 2010. Well, we see we didn't ever get that to work in 2010. But regardless, I think that, you know, we need to sort of look at, you know, we want to meet these conservation needs, these land protection needs, these water protection needs, but other people have other priorities and they need to see some of their needs met as well. I mean, as we see the school closing in Waldo and we see the condition of some of our roads and we see, you know, some of the other social and I mean, right now, one of the issues with Amendment 1 is we can't even hardly get a conversation about land conservation because of the low-income pool/Medicaid problem, which is extraordinarily big. So I think that we have to think that way. And just in closing, there are only 11 counties in Florida that don't have an infrastructure sales tax. We are one of those 11. So of the 67 counties, only 11 haven't taken advantage of that type of funding sources in a longer and sustained way.
Any other comments on that question? And, you know, building on that question, how can the city or county create enabling conditions that foster innovation in the creation of those model developments? I mean, we kind of have talked on that, but are there specific enabling conditions possibly, you know, not talking about incentives or disincentives, but what other conditions are within the county that help foster these good kinds of development? Mark, that seems like that's up your alley.
I think there's several roads. There's one is that the policies in LDRs don't inhibit creativity and trying out the alternative type of practice, because sometimes we run into that. So, like, I'll just give a quick example. When we were originally trying to get LID, low impact development, in and not using curbs
you gotta use the acronyms, you gotta explain to the audience.
Low impact development is defined many different ways. It's a whole suite of different practices, but one of the main drivers is how you deal with water quality across the development. But it's also open space and livability and health and some other variables. But the idea behind that is that if there is an engineer that has a list of rules of how you deal with stormwater and does include rain gardens and swales and permeable pavement, then it's going to hit a barrier right there. So one thing we need to do is figure out where those barriers are, where those bottlenecks are.
Right, and they may not be with the engineer. They may also be with the county itself when they go to permit. They're like, I can't calculate the swale in the backyard as part of the overall stormwater requirement for the neighborhood. So,
and what happened with that, I think that's moved on now, because right. There has been some examples where now that they put those in, they say, oh, well, look, it's dealt with the storm event quite just as good as conventional, so now we can give credit for those type of things. So that's one thing we need to do, is work through that. The second is perhaps if you're trying to really get some really alternative practices in there, let's say, you know, no irrigation about energy conservation, really those net zero homes, maybe there can be some incentives, financial incentives that could be a fast tracking permits, and then if you're going to fast track, you're going to have to make sure all your ducks in a row from the get-go, because sometimes you get these new development ideas coming through and it hits barrier after barrier, so we have to make sure those go through quicker than normal. Or two, a density bonus, I think, is another way to encourage alternative practices, at least to get some model examples out there that other built environment professionals could turn to. I mean, right now it's just an idea, but if you see it, then it gets enacted.
Well, places like Portland, Oregon, where they not only allow but encourage people to develop the spaces between houses and make it very easy for people to go to the edge of lot lines in urban environments and increase urban density. And if we're looking at, we're talking city here instead of county, I guess, but when you're looking at impact fees on a county level, and the impact fees are supposed to be for infrastructure, if you're building where there's already infrastructure, then do the impact fees have the same weight?
Yeah, and just for whatever it's worth, the city does not have impact fees.
Right, that's
the city, and I think also the county do have density bonus points for things they want to be done. What I will say, you know, having the scars to show for it, one of the challenges for Gainesville in particular is we're a city of 127,000 with 50,000 UF students included in that number, and another 18 or 20,000 Santa Fe students, and so I'm actually personally all in favor of mother-in-law suites, for example, and there are some of the upper-end traditional neighborhoods like Town of Tioga and Hale Village Center that actually do have those. When I brought that up, maybe slightly innocently, but maybe not so innocently, as an elected official, people, you know, called for my head on a platter, because what they see happening is, you know, the primary home being full of, you know, three students who now find three girlfriends or boyfriends, and then the mother-in-law suite having a few more, and before too long, every single lot is a party going on 24/7. So, I mean, we have some unique challenges in a community like ours that has such an extraordinary student population when it comes to, oh, let's change our land development codes and let everybody live, you know, comfortably together. Well, you know, good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked on a small redevelopment of a house where four women all came in and to live together. They remodeled the house, so each bedroom had a sitting room, a bedroom, a closet, and a bathroom, and then they all shared communally the kitchen and the family room areas. And this was a retirement setting for them, and they had a very complicated way of dealing with that legal system, but they also had to deal with rules that said there couldn't be four unrelated people living in the same house, so it's in their particular neighborhood, so they had to get all kinds of deal making to even make that kind of thing happen, which we would consider mostly a sustainable solution for, especially for aging in place. So so there are lots of barriers.
The college students figure out all of those little, oh, she's actually our live-in maid. Really? I mean, this is a real story from codes enforcement. She's our live-in maid. No, she belongs to the same sorority as you. It doesn't sound legitimate.
So let's see. We had a few more questions from the audience, and I'm trying to see if these focus on solutions. This is just a question. Feel free to have a brief answer. Do local communities have the power to challenge large private landowners if their business use endangers the local community? I don't know if that's a question that is part of this whole discussion or not, but if that's not one that anybody wants to address, I'll move on to the next one. How does the panel feel about paying for water, not to be confused with delivery cost? Now, water was one of our discussion items last month, but we have brought it up in this meeting as well. So, Mark, you're holding your hand up like you have something to say.
Just real quick, I mean, Bob mentioned that water's too cheap. I mean, we need to raise the price of water, and what that will do, I think, is, I remember there was a case in Germany where a town had very high stormwater rates, and what they did for like low impact development, if you converted when you redid your lot or you repaved your driveway and you reduced the amount of impervious surface, then you got a tax break for paying that stormwater fee because now you had more land that could percolate the water into the ground. But that only works, those type of incentives only work if water's expensive. So I think we can change, we can redevelop already neighborhoods that are built that can decrease the impervious surface if there was an incentive where the water was, I mean, dealing with water and also paying for consumption was increased in some way.
Well, What about our? Were you going to say something? Go ahead.
Oh, I dare not. Well, I will say this. The City of Gainesville's utility, GRU, which has been much maligned in the public in recent years, actually does have these public policies, both related to water and to energy. It's called an inverted block rate, meaning that the more you use, the more you pay per unit, which actually does work to reduce use of water and energy, which is why our service area has the lowest energy use per capita in the state of Florida and among the lowest water use. So it actually has been done. Again, the people who, you know, are out there in the community, unfortunately, many of them don't appreciate the resource value protection or the desire to change behaviors, fill in the blank. But the benefit is, in my opinion, is that, you know, people can choose to really conserve. They have control over it, and they can keep their own bills quite low. And in the course of adopting all of these policies, GRU actually actively mapped both energy and water use. It's available even on the internet. And you can look and see that there are some neighborhoods that, you know, the irrigation systems were all put in at the same time and they use a ridiculous amount of water. And then there are other neighborhoods that have no irrigation. They use virtually, you know, a portion, a small portion of that. So, I mean, a lot of the policies that we're talking about have been adopted. I'm not sure they're fully understood.